I'm Commander Shepard, and this is my favorite lorecast on the Citadel.
Welcome to the Mass Effect Lorecast, the podcast where we explore the vast universe of lore behind the Mass Effect games. We'll talk about all the details you may have missed, ask the hard questions, and more.
Spectres, welcome back to the Mass Effect Lorecast. This is your host, Tom, or Robots. I'm here with my good buddy N7, the legend, the legendary N7. Welcome back, dude. How's it going?
I'm well. So I've got some, you know, exciting news in my personal life, that I will be moving soon.
Man, again. Didn't you just move? I just moved.
Yeah. It was about a year and a half, or no, a year and some change ago.
Yeah.
But I will be moving again to Seattle.
Congratulations.
And that is for a new job. But yeah, I'll be willing to talk about more details about it a little bit later, but yeah, it's very exciting. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Well, congrats. That's big news. That's awesome. Hopefully we're able to, you know, keep up the shows, but you know, if we need to adjust some of the scheduling, we'll let people know. But this week we teased it last week. We're talking about Edie's origins, the origins of the Edie.
Yeah. Yeah. We've already, you know, kind of talked about, a lot already in this second year, you know, talking about the people that we see at the first parts of the game, like Anderson and Udina. But then more recently, we took a character dive into Joker and then the Normandy itself. So I find it only fitting that now we're going to talk about the ghost in the machine, Edie. So,
yeah.
And of course, Edie does stand for Enhanced Defense Intelligence.
Okay.
So what was when you first met Edie in Mass Effect 2, when Edie was, you know, just a glowing orb?
Right.
What were your first impressions of Edie?
You know, I don't think I thought too much about Edie. I think I was such a focus on the other characters. Edie seemed like a secondary thing that didn't. I had no anticipation of where Edie's story was going. Let's say that I kind of took Edie for granted. I'm sorry, Edie. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it's pretty easy, I think, to dismiss Edie as a background support kind of narrative tool at first, because you don't really see it until 3. And I think Edie was an interesting addition to Mass Effect, even just as that AI on the ship thing, because now you have this asset that's so familiar to so many other series, like the AI on the ship, right? That's so common, you know, having the ship AI or Android or someone that's kind of like running the day-to-day operations of the ship.
I mean, that goes all the way back to Star Trek, having a...
Exactly.
Like, and it's not a high intelligence in the early Star Treks. It's not like it's a person, but it's intelligent enough to understand speech and to respond to questions and do those kinds of things. I think that you could probably look back to Star Trek as being kind of a, I don't know, an origin for the concept, and then something like Edie, someone like Edie from Mass Effect being kind of a fulfillment of that concept.
Oh yeah, definitely. And then of course she's voiced by Trisha Helfer, who people might recognize from Battlestar Galactica. She was also an AI in that series.
Yeah, I mean, she was a Cylon. So yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. She was like a biological Cylon, but still a Cylon.
Yeah. So, and you know, speaking of which, according to the Art of Mass Effect book, Edie was modeled after an even older sci-fi character, way older than Star Trek. A lot of people might not recognize this name. Some people might if they're diehard sci-fi fans, but Edie was modeled after Maria in Metropolis.
So we did an episode of the Cyberpunk Lorecast where we talked about Metropolis, the movie from like 1928, something like this.
Yeah, I
remember. It was about that. I don't remember exactly the date. This is a black and white movie, and it predicted a lot, or I guess you could say a lot of sci-fi pulled ideas from the movie later on. I mean, it's definitely the 1920s. Like, there's definitely a lot of 1920s going on, but there are some concepts in there that are foundational for sci-fi. So this concept of like an AI is...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the grandmother of a lot of modern sci-fi.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a cyborg woman who is built as a machine, but then takes on the appearance of a person, and you can't tell that it's not a person. It's like central to the concept of the movie.
Right. And of course, Edie's model doesn't really come in until Mass Effect 3, when Edie obtains a robotic body. But first, we're going to get into how Edie enters the game in Mass Effect 2.
Right. So, okay. So this is a talking orb model only.
Yeah.
Episode.
Yeah. Right. Basically, this episode is going to focus on when Edie's an orb, but she's an omnipresent orb at that on the Normandy, because she kind of is the Normandy SR2, with her brain being located in the AI core, at least at first. And now technically she's powered by quantum computing, which I found to be interesting, but it's specifically called like a blue box quantum AI, which I tried to do my own digging about what exactly a blue box quantum AI is. And I couldn't find very much. So I feel like it might be one of those, you know, titles that the writers just make up and they're like, it's sci-fi.
It's a thing. Yeah. But quantum computing is definitely a real thing. And it's something that we're like every year they're making strides on, which is crazy. This idea of, simply put, computers based on silicon and electrons and that kind of technology are limited because you can only make the parts to a certain size and they can no longer get small enough. But if you can make quantum computers based on quantum mechanical movements, then the scale gets so much smaller than that of an electron.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so it makes sense how you could attain an actual AI that way.
Yeah, because of the number of operations that would need to be done in order for something to be complex enough to become self-aware. Yeah.
And definitely. And you know, while she gets a title role in Mass Effect 2, she actually appears in the game much before we ever hear the name Edie, although she's not quite at the quantum computing level yet, I think.
Oh, so, okay. So when was this? Do we know that we meet her? Is it one of those things where if you go back and you play through, you go, oh,
yeah. Yeah. You would have to replay it to know you're meeting her when you meet her. Uh-huh. And she actually enters the Mass Effect universe in Mass Effect 1, through a side mission on the moon and by a different name, kind of.
Okay.
So do you remember the mission in Mass Effect 1 where Shepard has to fight off a rogue VI on the Alliance's Luna base?
Vaguely. This, I haven't gone and redone all the side missions over and over again, like many of you guys have.
it is an easy to miss side mission, I think.
Yeah.
But it takes Shepard to the moon. Hackett hits up Shepard with another honeydew list item, saying, "Shepard, there's this batshit VI that's going haywire and attacking personnel at the base. I need you to go in and disable it. Hack it out."
That's it.
That's my Hackett impression.
Love you, buddy.
And you know, it sounds pretty run of the mill, right? Like, you know, okay, military VI is going crazy, you know, hacking, you know, turrets that are shooting people, and just go in there and take it out. And aside from how fucking cool it is that we get to go to the moon,
right?
It's pretty cool, because it has this really awesome lore explanation later. But this mission also rewards the player with a specialization within their class. So it has tangible gameplay benefits too. Mm-hmm. So you unlock some pretty great buffs for other powers that you have and some awesome passive abilities. But throughout this mission though, this damn VI, it just keeps proving to be a rather annoying foe, fighting back against what would be its destruction. You know, you're going through this like subterranean base that are in Mass Effect 1, more or less copy and pasted, you know, the subterranean bases.
Yeah, yeah.
And in each doorway, like after you disable one of the mainframes, the VI keeps booting up these shields that you have to like shoot through. And it's just kind of annoying.
Yeah. Self-preservation. What?
Yeah, I know. Right. It's like, but that's the thing. What if VI have self-preservation? Right.
I mean, assuming if something's self-aware, I think isn't that one of the requirements for like determining self-awareness, is that like self-preservation would be inherent to it or something like that?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. That's definitely one of the hallmarks of sentience. And as it pertains to Edie, we'll talk about that a little bit later. But there, it even gets to the point where you get to one mainframe room and you're destroying the mainframes, and then the VI starts pumping noxious gas. into the room.
Okay. Yeah. I feel like I remember this part. Yeah.
Very clearly fighting back. And well, we find out much later in the series that that was Edie in prototype form. Edie was basically born from that VI and then combined with Reaper tech that was preserved from the remains of Sovereign. And it creates this all knowing Normandy electronic warfare suite.
Sweet. So our good buddy Edie tried to murder us and is also Reaper tech.
Teehee. Isn't that funny?
That's so kind of that makes me a little bit more cautious about trusting her. So how much of this do you think was like planned ahead of time? Were they like, hey, we're going to put this side quest in and then we can use it as a launching pad for some sort of AI thing that we build out later that eventually becomes the Normandy? Or do you think this was more of like a, hey, wouldn't it be cool if Normandy was like had some personality and, oh, we have this story thing we did. Why don't we just pull from that?
Yeah, I think maybe both. The huge fan of BioWare in me says that they planned it from the get-go. But they've gone that route in the past with some of Anderson's stories in the novels, because if you remember the first Anderson novel, Mass Effect Revelations, that came out before the game did.
Right.
And it was probably written alongside the same time. But knowing how much narrative direction they changed from Mass Effect 1 to 3, and that's when it's explained later in Mass Effect 3. And with Drew Karpyshyn, who is kind of the lore father of the series, he left the project to work on Star Wars, the Old Republic, before the trilogy was over. I don't know. You know, maybe it was a simple restocking of what they had already done. Maybe it was some people in the development team looking at the previous games and thinking, right here, this is a good callback. We can make a callback here. Mm-hmm. And people will love that. So maybe it was both. I really want it to be planned from the start, but I don't know if it is.
Yeah. Okay, so what we have here is a formerly rogue VI that wreaks havoc on the moon. Like, this is very close to Earth, right? The freaking moon. Mm-hmm. Then is developed with Reaper tech and then put onto maybe the most expensive starship in the galaxy. And they're all just like, sounds good.
Yeah, when you put it like that, genius idea.
Right, brilliant.
What could go wrong, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, but I guess you could add the other thing is that it is being commanded by the most important Spectre to ever been a Spectre, right? Like,
right.
And all of the fate of everybody hinges on this one crew and what they're able to accomplish.
And I see where you're going with that. And, you know, and let's remember Cerberus is also the entity that oversaw Edie's creation.
Right. Okay. Yeah, add Cerberus into the mix. Yeah. This is turning into a really good stew.
We also know how much that Cerberus likes to control. They like to control things. And so they did institute locks on Edie's behavior to keep her from turning rogue like that VI did on the moon and becoming an unshackled AI. So unshackled AI, basically meaning completely self-aware, allowed to change their own programming, make additions and upgrades to themselves.
Determine that the crew is the most likely threat to them and so kill everybody on board.
Right. I can't let you do that, Dave.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. So she can't actually make all the decisions on the ship when we meet her in Mass Effect 2. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's kind of why Joker is still hired and still around. Like, technically,
and comedic timing.
And that,
yeah,
of course.
Right.
But, you know, in the lore explanation, he has to be the one to fly it because she's not allowed. It's not that she couldn't.
Right.
She could.
Right.
And in fact, she does at points. But she's just not allowed. And there's a ton of things that she's not allowed to do because Cerberus has placed these blocks on her. In fact, every time that you're talking to Edie in Mass Effect 2 and you ask her a question, some of that information is partitioned off and not allowed to be given to Shepard because Cerberus doesn't want Shepard to know. And you'll know if you've run into one of those things because the blue portion of Edie's like mouth will glow red.
Like, stop. Can't go any further. Yeah.
Yeah, open the pod bay doors, hell. But she does monitor the systems on the ship, even so. And she advises of potential improvements to efficiency or warning the crew of metaphorical or literal fires happening. So since organics can't watch everything else at once, you know, it's pretty useful. And she's also hooked up to the squad's suits, though.
Right.
Seeing what I believe if there's, you know, cameras on the suits, you know, hardware that she's getting all those feeds to.
Big and sister.
She's monitoring biometrics and GPS feedback and advising them of things like where to go and how to accomplish objectives and fourth wall breaking. That's very convenient, you know, for the player.
Of course. I mean, obviously, this is like from the meta perspective, this is a very gameplay oriented decision and narrative oriented decision, like how to string things together and make sure information is passed from one place to another easily. Like, why don't we have an AI that's just aware of everything that's going on all the time? That kind of solves it. Right. But
and lore
wise, I can see the benefit of this, but it still sounds really dangerous at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think Cerberus felt like, OK, we're playing with fire here, but we're arrogant enough to think that we can control everything. So,
right. Haven't seen rich people make decisions like that before.
Never. No. Rich people are famously not arrogant.
Not arrogant, but not risk takers. Yeah.
Never.
Okay.
All hail rich people. But yeah, like you said, like lore wise, Edie is essentially at that point like Q from MI6, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
And but better than Q, because Edie is more intelligent and can be everywhere and analyze, you know, like zettabytes of information within seconds, you know. Mm-hmm. So Edie does serve as that narrative propelling device, giving crucial lore context on multiple topics like Cerberus itself to the player, things that the player wouldn't otherwise know.
Right.
But her AI capabilities allowed the writers a lot of room to use her to do everything from serve as that encyclopedia to activate groundside defenses while Shepard's away, you know, on a mission, or analyzing the obtained collector DNA and letting Shepard know, hey, I just compared this with every known sample of Prothean DNA and they're like 98% similar.
It took me like 0.027 seconds. It's like a Google search. That's like this search results returned to you in 0.00372 seconds.
Exactly. It's a Google search that's listening to you and automatically searching when you have a question.
Yeah. It's basically Alexa.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is pretty intricate, you know, but Edie is one of those characters who is used as a method of teaching the player more about the universe. And there's several like that, you know, throughout, there's so many like that throughout fiction. And sometimes if it's poorly written fiction, I find it's very easy to identify those lines and those characters.
Right.
But this wasn't one of those cases to me.
I think that the reason Edie works is because it's a natural assumption that you would have intelligent computers, whether it's self-aware AI or not, but you would have intelligent, highly, highly sophisticated, very fast processing, large databases of all the knowledge they could possibly download at any point or connect to and get, you know, very quickly. Like that technology in this future setting, when you have so many other advantageous technologies, seems like, I mean, there's no question, right? Like this is something that would exist.
Yeah, definitely. It's not out of the ordinary. It doesn't feel plopped down there out of a different series or something.
Right. It doesn't even feel like space magic. Like sometimes, like what we talked about with the name of the blue box, right? Sometimes it's just space magic words. It's like science words that sound sciency, but it's really just space magic.
Schematics.
Right.
Blueprints.
Right. This like actually having a kind of self-aware, but yet all-knowing, very fast intelligence seems like where things, I mean, if you were to do this successfully and create the boundaries around that personality, this seems like what you might get.
Yes, but it's twofold. So it's not just like a tool to help them, mm-hmm. because Cerberus also wanted to keep eyes and ears on their investment, and specifically the Elusive Man's investment.
Just like Alexa.
just like Alexa. And if you're listening at home right now and wondering whether Alexa could turn into Edie someday, you may be warranted in that. Uh-huh. You know, Edie does in fact listen and monitor all parts of the ship all the time and was meant to serve as the elusive man's eyes and ears. And right. we know this in a few ways, one of which is pretty awkward. Edie asks about developing a relationship with Joker in Mass Effect 3. And it's when you're on shore leave at the Citadel. Uh-huh. And she starts the conversation with, Shepard, you've had sex before.
Like, it's like, not as a question, but as a statement. Like, I know because I've seen it.
Exactly. And like, I remember thinking, like, the first time, like, wait a second, how do you, oh, that's how you know that.
Yeah, you know everything.
You've been watching me bone for three games now. No, yeah. two games now.
Right. Yeah. Or anything else awkwardly you're doing by yourself, quote unquote, by yourself. Yeah. Nope.
Yeah.
Nope. You know, yeah, you know every time that you got the runs. Like,
you think the elusive man would
You've had diarrhea seven times this year, Shepard.
I've been monitoring your biometrics. You like, need more fiber today.
Right. Everything.
How likely do you think it is that the elusive man would be one of those people who puts cameras in the bathroom?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. He wants to control everything.
Yes.
Maybe everything. Not for personal enjoyment of, like, you know, like the creeper who likes to see somebody go to use the restroom, but just for the knowledge. Absolutely.
And to manipulate people.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. You clearly have hemorrhoid problems, so I'm going to use that against you.
Shepard spent a lot of time on the toilet lately.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So
now that we've been saying these things in front of my Alexa, I'm going to start getting advertisements for hemorrhoid cream.
And my phone is within earshot, so I will.
My phone, too. Yes. All of that. Yeah. All of that stuff is true, by the way. Like, I've worked in marketing. It's true. Like, It's 100%.
Yeah. I tested this before. Uh-huh. I tested this when I was like, I kept getting these Hulu ads for things that didn't make sense. And then I remembered, oh my God, I was just talking about that last week. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I tested it and I intentionally started talking about Indian food a lot. Uh-huh. And then guess what? I got Indian food ads. Yeah.
Without ever doing a Google search, without ever like engaging on your PC or your phone in typing those words in. Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Exactly. I'm like, I caught you, you motherfucker.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And Cloudy Atlas here in chat says, I mean, Edie also talks about measuring heat signatures of erogenous zones. So
yeah,
Edie sees everything.
Yeah. Cause I mean, all you have to do is have a camera with like a heat sensor on it with like, cause you can tell. Right.
Visually. I'm imagining Edie making the predator noises, like the clicks. So, yeah, now that we've thoroughly creeped everyone out, maybe Alexa is reporting to our real life elusive man. We're on to you.
Wait,
Mr. Bookseller.
Is this why Bezos wants to go into space?
He's a huge fan of Mass Effect and he's just cosplaying the elusive man.
He's sitting in his uncomfortable chair in the evenings going, what's the next step I can take to become the elusive man? That's amazing.
The elusive man's real life origin story is a guy who is selling books from his apartment. And now look at him.
He's going to save / dominate the galaxy. All right. Well, let me restart. Edie isn't always shackled, right? She gains more capabilities as the series goes on. But I think we probably need to wait until after the midbreak.
That's a pretty deep topic, and we can talk about that more when we come back.
Also, I did mess up my words. Yeah. All right. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, scientists. How critical is pure water to you? In this new podcast, Lab Water Stories Unfiltered, we at Millipore Sigma look closer at this often overlooked lab essential. Tune in as experts drop tips and insights not found in textbooks, taken from their work with Millicue Lab Water Solutions. Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Millipore Sigma is the U.S. and Canada life science business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Message coming in. Patching it through.
I am sovereign, and this station is mine. I like the sound of that.
All right, here we are in the middle of the show, and this is where we get to thank our amazing patrons. And let's see, I don't think we thanked Cable X Ascani Clan. That's quite the name, Cable. Thank you for signing up with us on the Patreon. Welcome. Welcome, welcome, and big shout out to all 61 of our patrons. We're at 61. Do you think? I mean, we've already broke a boundary here, Sam. Do you think we could get 8 more patrons and get to 69 by next week?
I don't know. Should we like reserve like a special something for patron number 69?
Maybe. But then maybe nobody else will sign up until it gets to 68, and then everybody will rush to hit 69. But I don't know. Maybe we'll just call whoever becomes patron 69, patron 69 from now on.
Patron number 69.
Yeah, there you go. But big thanks to everybody. Also, all of our Shepherd tier patrons, Kolkashins, Captain Shanko, Kira, Lieutenant Tosino, Pipe Man, and Big Bills 63. Thank you so much to all of you guys. You guys are amazing. We couldn't do this without you. We've talked about that before. And let's see. I don't think we have any new reviews this week. I think we covered everything last time.
We do have a couple of new ones, I was going to save those for the next episode.
Yeah, usually we do the next episode. I'm just spitballing here. I feel like this one on the third, maybe we didn't cover this one. Oh, yeah, it's been a little while, right? We took a break.
Yes, we did.
Okay. Well, there you go. Usually I just look for stuff that's coming in the last week. You're right. We'll cover that stuff on the next mid-break from the next episode. But other than that, thank you, everybody, for helping and supporting us. Anything else you want to share? I've got something I want to share, but anything else you want to share?
Well, you know, I'm always, always, always grateful for our patrons, and they have helped me immensely. They're going to help me again when I move. The monetary support that they give this podcast, it's going to soften the blow for me a lot when I move. So awesome. I want them all to understand that they are having a tangible effect on my life beyond just being extremely supportive members of this community.
Yeah. Yeah. And another way they can be extremely supportive members of the community is subbing to our YouTube channel, where they can watch our wonderful, beautiful faces talk about all these wonderful things. And so if you want to find the YouTube channel, just search Mass Effect on YouTube, Mass Effect Lorecast specifically on YouTube. You'll find it. We're getting closer and closer to 1,000 subs, which means we can monetize the channel. We become a real channel, guys. That would be awesome. Also, Sam and I are working on a side project. Should we tell them a little bit about our side project?
I've kept it pretty hush hush, so I think now might be the time.
Yeah, so we like to dabble in other things, and I hit Sam up with this idea, and there are all these really cool mods out for Mass Effect and a bunch of other games. Skyrim Together is out. You can play Skyrim with your friends. Elden Ring has a co-op mod. There's a bunch of cool mods. Sam and I love modding games, and we thought, you know what? We should do like a YouTube channel / series on modding stuff. So we're going to be doing a regular show called Mod Masters as our little side project, and we'll be streaming games when we stream games, some of my streams, and I don't know if some of Sam's streams, and maybe we'll guest on each other's streams, and we'll try out mods together. We'll have like a weekly YouTube video that we put up that's all about the things that we learned, the best mods to install for many of these games, all of that kind of stuff. That's all going to be on the Robots Radio channel. It's going to be kind of the part of the main focus of that. I've done a lot of mod videos before. I don't always regularly do them, but every so often I dabble in them. But this will mean that you're going to get regular mod videos for all the games that we love. So if you aren't following the Robots Radio channel on YouTube, also go look that up, because that's where you're going to see our faces doing more stuff. And if you aren't following N7 The Legend on Twitch or Robots Radio on Twitch and YouTube for our live streams, then that's a great place for you to make sure that you're tuning in for when we're co-streaming games that we're playing together and all that kind of stuff. So it's going to be a lot of fun. It means more live streams from me. It means awesome, more content from me and Sam together and Sam's channel. So stay tuned for all of that. That should be kicking off sometime in the next week or two. And then, of course, you've got your changing jobs thing. So we'll adjust as we need to get that stuff done. But that's on the table. And that's all we got for the middle of the show this week. Let's move on with the rest of the show.
Spit it out, or are you trying to build suspense?
You're so dense, sir. Obviously, I do not know as much about human relationships as I thought.
All right, so back to Edie. We know that Edie was developed as a way for the Normandy to be under constant diagnostics and surveillance. We've already discussed all that part of it. But here's the real question. Is she a person?
Now, that's a tough question, to say the least, because that's when she was shackled.
Right.
You know, there were programming blocks that prevented her from feeling these things intrinsic to sentient existence, like self-preservation, like we talked about earlier. So that kind of brings to mind the question of what makes sentient life sentient versus what is just a VI.
Yeah. What self-awareness, the ability to, you know, the need for self-preservation, I guess, not even the ability, the need for it. Because if something can't maintain its own existence, then that seems like a questionable decision from anything that has some sort of self-awareness or intelligence, sentience, right?
Right. Because if you don't understand that you exist, why work to preserve it? And why work to preserve your existence?
Right. And if you do understand that you exist, then wouldn't that be on the top of your priority list?
Yes.
Unless something of greater importance requires you to sacrifice that. Like, for example, protecting your family or children, or, you know, something of greater value in the big picture based on some ideological belief or, you know, something like that.
And so that like brings a question to mind. You know, a lot of animals have self-preservation instincts, but we don't refer to them as sentient.
Right.
So obviously self-preservation cannot be the only criteria in which we decide that something is sentient or not. I absolutely love my pets that I've had, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure that all of them have been self-aware. I do think that one of my dogs was pretty close to that. Uh-huh. I question whether or not he was.
This is going to get reactions. I sometimes wonder what percentage of the human population is actually self-aware. and I mean, that comes across as kind of a joke, as like, yeah, some people are idiots. But like on a actual foundational, like philosophical level, the inability and the difficulty it is, even within myself, to make myself do the things I know I should do and actually take control over myself is very, very difficult. Think about any time you tried to stay on a diet, or any time you try to make the better decision or motivate yourself to do good on a regular basis. The things that don't come naturally, the things that don't seem to be just inherently programmed into our brains, forcing ourselves away from the inherent program, the ability to just turn down a cookie when someone says, like, here's some sweets, you want one? And you're like, I probably shouldn't have one, but okay. And you eat it anyway, right?
Like, hopefully this makes the pain go away. Yeah, that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Or to stop drinking alcohol or stop smoking or anything that we know we have control over, but we don't really, like, it's so hard to wrestle control over ourselves. This isn't an external thing at all. It's so difficult as humans to do that regularly. And so few people genuinely succeed at that. Like, I mean, this is like Maslow's hierarchy of needs kind of thing,
sure.
Right? Like the
so
top of the hierarchy.
Are you saying that maybe then a part of the criteria for sentience should be not just self-control, but deciding things on a purely rational basis?
Being able to actually wrestle control of things and make decisions, actively making decisions over your life and your circumstances on a regular basis.
And not just responding to needs.
Not just responding. Because if you're just responding to needs, then are we really different from any other animal out in the world? Like a bear responds to its needs. It doesn't make greater decisions. It's
sure.
like it's on autopilot, right? And most of the time, people, myself included, are on autopilot.
Sure. And then that brings to mind pleasure seeking behavior.
Right.
Not all animals have pleasure seeking behavior.
Sure.
A lot of them do. Humans obviously do.
Yeah.
But a lot of the decisions that human beings make that are not need based are because they're pleasure based.
Right. And that's still like an autopilot thing. That's still a lizard brain thing. You know, like I'm doing the thing, I'm eating the cookie because it tastes good, not because I need the nourishment. I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't need those carbs and sugar. You know, if I was making a rational decision, I would say, no, thank you. Do you have any vegetables? Right. Like, because that's going to nourish my body and make me a stronger, healthier, better person. But I don't usually do that, even though I know I should. I don't.
But if we have this life full of habits where we're only making the decisions based off of what's rational, do I need the vegetables? Do I not?
Right.
That doesn't feel human to me.
Right. I don't think that the requirement is that you always make rational decisions. The question I have is, are there people who never make rational decisions and never actually mm-hmm. wrestle control of themselves, or live their entire lives in automatic mode? And if that's the case, are those people truly sentient?
I feel like that. I don't want to, you know, dole out a slippery slope fallacy,
this could be very dangerous, because if you were to go by that philosophy, then does that justify that they're not actually human? Does that justify bad things against them? I totally understand the entire picture of what I'm saying here, but it makes me wonder, like, are there people who simply never wrest control of themselves from themselves in order to make higher functioning decisions?
I suppose that's one of the limitations that we would always have to wonder about, because we cannot place ourselves in someone else's consciousness.
Absolutely. We don't think we can ever know for sure, which is probably good if the answer is yes. Right. But it's just simply on philosophical terms. I'm not trying to preach anything. I'm not even saying I believe this or I don't believe this. I'm just saying I wonder because we don't know.
I think a large part of that is also due to how skilled of a communicator is the person, because you can have all these deep thoughts, but if you can't communicate them, no one knows you're a genius.
Right. Or do things that seem antithetical to what seems best. But if you actually rationalized it out and made the tough decision to do the thing, then you actually wrestled control over yourself in order to do a thing, which shows that you are sentient. So I think on the far extreme side of determining sentience, to wrap this kind of back around, a creature that does things that goes against its basic programming for a greater good is probably a very clear sign of sentience.
Yes,
and
I would agree.
And on top of that, I think most humans do that. Maybe don't do it for every decision. In fact, none of us do it for every decision. But at some point in their lives, they do those kinds of things, right?
Yeah, and having ideals and acting on those ideals, at least on Earth, seems to be very human. It's very sentient. It's one of the hallmarks of sentience, where I think you could certainly make an argument that Edie has ideals. Mm-hmm. And that leads me to my next point. Edie becomes ultimately unshackled. And for better or for worse, I'm going to let the, philosophers argue that one. But Edie becomes ultimately unshackled to avoid losing the entire Normandy and Joker when the collectors attack the ship and abduct the crew. And arguably, it is a good thing in that circumstance that Edie was unshackled, but that key decision is made under duress from Joker. And it leads to this entire personality developing for Edie. It unlocks so many other possibilities. It allows Edie to take full control of the Normandy. It allows her to analyze her own coding and make changes, which is probably key to freeing her from Cerberus's control. Mm-hmm. And it allows Edie to examine her own existence. Beforehand, she's basically a super intelligent VI that isn't really allowed to contemplate the fact that she's a slave to the program, but she's acutely aware of the programming.
Right, right, right. Doing the thing, but not acting against the thing.
Right. So,
or not even able to act against the thing, or be aware ultimately of really what the thing is, the situation she's actually in.
How many thoughts was she not allowed to make known because of those blocks in her programming, you know? And that's not to say, though, that Edie has no personality to start with. She does make several jokes while still shackled that are pretty funny. In Mass Effect 2, if you go to this, you know, our own local solar system and you probe Uranus, she says, "Really, Commander?"
Like, right. Like, she's aware of the pun. That's
Edie's well aware of the joke there. And she also jokes about, you know, venting the Normandy. basically killing all of the crew, but it's deadpan and it's not entirely clear that it's a joke, which I think is pretty funny in itself, because it's like she's still learning how to make appropriate jokes, kind of like a kid.
Right, right. She has to test out the waters and go, does this delivery work? Yeah, okay.
Right. And yeah. have your kids ever made jokes where you're like, oh, that was a little dark?
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Or just like, or I'm sure every parent knows this, the thing many kids do is they'll say a thing they think is funny and then they don't get the reaction they were wanting, and then they'll double down and keep talking about it. And my son's very much like that right now, and I have to look at him and go, dude, it didn't work the first time, it's not going to work the fourth, like like, sorry, it's just, maybe try a different joke. like and I'm not trying to be mean, but I'm trying to just like get him to be like, to read the room, right? That's basically my response, is like, read the room. Like, it didn't land, try something else. Not
maybe
the same
parents
joke
out there who are just like, boo, you suck, get off the stage.
right.
Ruin tomatoes. I hope not. But Edie says a lot of things like that. And I see Cage Nephilim here in chat says, I love seeing humans on their knees. She says that as a joke. And that is pretty funny, because, you know, I think it takes a little while to understand that Edie is deadpan, and that it's not exactly clear when Edie's being sarcastic, because Edie, I think, doesn't understand the different inflections in voice yet.
Sure. Fact that it's freaking terrifying to think of her becoming some sort of like AI overlord or something. Yeah.
Or maybe she does realize that it's terrifying and she just likes toying with
just
the idea.
Pokes everybody.
Right. She just likes poking the buttons, saying like, yeah, I might become murderous. Who knows? Just kidding. I love you guys.
Yeah.
Edie also says a lot of things that are the robotic versions of phrases that we've heard plenty of times. And on my most recent playthrough, I've run into this time and time again. Edie will say something and I'm like, oh my God, that's just the writers making one of our colloquial phrases more robotic. For example, she says, when she's asked about the budding relationship between Joker and Edie, Edie says, quote, what Jeff and I are exhibiting is more like a platonic symbiosis rather than hormonally induced courtship behavior, which is a very, very robotic way of saying, we're just friends, Shepard.
Right.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, we're just friends. But those phrases are, and those jokes, they slowly become more complex, more relatable, more human, for lack of a better term, after Joker unshackles Edie. If you go back to the AI core after she has become unshackled, Edie will tell you, quote, since Jeff connected me to the rest of the Normandy, I'm effectively everywhere at once. You walk within my body, tickling me with your footsteps. That is a joke.
That is a joke. Like, it just, in case you didn't know.
just to make sure you don't think I'm losing my marbles. That's right. A joke.
Or it actually tickles when you walk around.
Yeah, that I'm like, so they become more complex. They become more relatable, where you're like, oh, okay, that was a little bit more funny. And it's not just because I don't think it's just because the player is adapting to Edie's sense of humor. I think it's just that, like, Edie is becoming more humorous and more relatable. So props to the writing team on Mass Effect on making Edie's transition to fully sentient AI rather seamless from these subtle developments in her dialogue, even within Mass Effect 2. Of course, it becomes more evident for us as players in Mass Effect 3 once she has a body, but, you know, we can get into that in the next episode.
Yeah. Yeah. Good on you, writers.
It is. And good on them. Let's have a round of applause for the writers.
I think I've got, here we go.
Oh, do you have one?
Oh, it's very quiet.
It's a golf clap.
It's like a really far away crowd.
they're awesome. And they're cheering. They're just like really far down the road.
Yeah, we're in the Normandy and they're on the moon clapping up at us, which doesn't even make sense because the atmosphere wouldn't even make it, but whatever. All right, so go on.
You know, but like you mentioned earlier, the fear of making this AI from a rogue VI that already went bad before and then combining that with Reaper tech, I think it was probably prudent of Cerberus to put those shackles on her. They couldn't be sure if the Reapers could take full remote control. But then again, maybe they shouldn't have used Reaper tech in the first place. I don't know. I mean, I feel like that would be playing with fire inherently. But again, the Elusive Man thinks he can control everything, right?
Right. And they do use Reprotect in a lot of ways. So,
like reviving Shepard, right? Actually, I've seen some back and forth about that, about whether Shepard technically has Reprotect within them. My personal opinion is, if it's not confirmed in the lore, I think it's a fair inference to make. But it also makes sense then why Edie herself would die in the Destroy ending, given that she had Reprotect within her. Not all of the Geth did, though. Not all of the Geth had Reprotect in them. And we are seeing more of them teased in media promoting the future games.
That brings up a good point. So why is Shepard so trusting that Edie isn't of the same breed as the other bad machines, you know, like the Geth and the Reapers?
Edie does straight up tell Shepard that she works very hard on analyzing anti-Reaper algorithms, which is basically a cyber defense against the Reapers. And it's because of the Reaper tech within Edie that she's able to compete with the super advanced organic machines. So she's forthcoming about this truth that she didn't have to tell Shepard.
Right. But to play a devil's advocate, if you were trying to protect yourself from Shepard getting upset at you and potentially turning you off or destroying you, you would come up with an explanation that would feed what would make him feel good about it. Right.
That's true. But you would only do that if you had a fear that Shepard would find out otherwise.
Right. Right. So I get what you're saying. It's just this is the problem with any good justification, is if she does have self-awareness and self-preservation, then she would lie about it in order to try to maintain herself.
Well, I feel like that is an inference that we make because the only sentient beings we understand that we know are human beings, and human beings lie. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't necessarily mean that all AI would be inherently less trustworthy.
I think that's probably another debate for another time. I think
it's largely up to the individual player, though.
Yeah. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just kind of just pushing the other button.
But, you know, no matter if you choose Paragon or Renegade in the interactions with Edie, there's a certain level of the interactions being on rails. And I think that's because after interacting with Edie long enough, it becomes evident to Shepard that Edie genuinely gives a shit about the welfare of those around and inside her.
Tickling her insides. Yeah, I think you're right about that. Like, I think that's probably a better way to understand the truth of the matter, is the actions Edie takes.
Yes.
And who they benefit.
Yeah, there would have been plenty of actions that Edie could have taken to benefit only Edie and get ahead and then possibly become even more powerful than the Reapers if Edie made those calculations. Mm-hmm. Or on the flip side, if you really want to turn this lore on its head, what's the possibility that Edie looked at all of the variables around and realized it doesn't matter if I do anything self-benefiting, because if I do that, we're all going to die.
That's the end. Yeah.
And what if Edie became evil, you know, after the Reapers, after the bigger bad was taken care of?
It was a temporary thing. Like, I know I have to help this crew because they're the only solution to keep me and everyone else alive, but me alive. Once they're gone, I don't need to take care of them anymore.
Right. But given what Edie says to us, Edie, if that was truly how Edie was thinking, then Edie is the scariest sociopath to ever be in fiction.
I mean, it totally makes sense. I mean, that seems like a very legitimate thing. It seems like the kind of justifications you see like business people making, you know, like, well, we'll pair up for now, but once this is over, I can totally do the other thing.
Right.
You know, like that kind of thing. So what do you think that there's actual morality developing here?
I think there is. And I think it's something that we'll get more into in the next episode when we talk about Edie's character and her sultry body.
It's her sultry body. Yes, she's very feminine for sure.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, that's it for this episode. Make sure you tune in for the follow-up episode for more about Edie and Mass Effect 3. And Seven, you got anything going on you want to share?
Yeah, of course. Like we mentioned in the mid-break, I'm excited to start that Mod Masters show with you. And then, because I am a huge fan of modding games, I've got a number of mods in Mass Effect, actually. And I've downloaded some really killer ones that I've been having a great time playing, and I can't wait to talk about them. But if you want to catch any of that gameplay, I'm streaming the modded Mass Effect playthrough on Saturdays on Twitch, and streaming some other games as well, like The Witcher and Dragon Age,
which you can both mod. You can mod both those as well.
Yeah, exactly. And yep. I'm planning on it. So if you'd like to catch any of that, you can follow me on Twitch at N7 The Legend.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm all my stuff's at Robots Radio stuff on different channels. So Twitch, YouTube, wherever, robotsradio.net for all my shows and all the other stuff. And today I tried out Skyrim Together redone. I think it's redone. With my son, who's 12, and he's never played through Skyrim. He played like maybe an hour of it once. So that's been a lot of fun. It's actually working better than you would expect. And so he also uses a voice, like a vocoder thing on his voice for the voice chat. So he sounds kind of like a little robot. It's pretty funny. But that's,
I mean, he is a little robot.
He's a little robot.
You're a robot. So yeah,
that's true. It's true. But that's on my Robots Radio channels. I'll be doing more of those streams. Sam and I are maybe going to stream tomorrow night for those of you on the live show, because it'll be too late for those of you on the recorded versions. But that's Tuesday night. Maybe we'll do something in the evening tomorrow. Maybe try out some Skyrim or Elden Ring or something together and see how that goes. So come join us for that stuff. But otherwise, you guys know where all the other fun times are. That doesn't make any sense. Oh, man.
Words is hard.
Yeah, words is hard. But that's it for this episode. Chat, don't go anywhere. We're going to kick off the next episode right now. For those of you listening at home, you have to wait a few days. But here we go. All right. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for tuning into the Mass Effect Lorecast. We'd love to hear your opinion and thoughts on the lore of Mass Effect. Reach out to us on Twitter at Mass Effect Cast, or check out the Robots Radio Discord. Also, you can send us an email at masseffectlorecast@gmail.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.